Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hi, this is Matthew Christopher, creator of the Abandoned America book series, website, and the podcast you're listening to. Thanks for listening, and I hope you're enjoying it so far. If you are, and you'd like to support the podcast and help keep it going, there are three things you can do that'll really help out. The first is simple. Just tell your friends and family about it, or leave a positive review on your podcast platform if they support it. Good word of mouth makes a huge difference. Second, if you'd like to hear early episodes and see exclusive essays and photos that aren't on my website yet, you can become a patron at patreon.com/abandonedamerica. That's patreon.com/abandonedamerica. Third, if you'd like to advertise on the podcast, just drop me a note at admin@abandonedamerica.org. That's admin@abandonedamerica.org. Every little bit counts, and I've got some really exciting episodes that I think you'll love coming up. Don't forget, you can also visit my website, abandonedamerica.us, for tons of photo galleries and background info on hundreds of abandoned sites, or order my two Abandoned America books from your favorite retailer.
Hi. I'm Matt Lambros, photographer and host of the upcoming After the Final Curtain podcast. If you like what you're about to listen to on the Abandoned America podcast, and I'm sure you will, check out the After the Final Curtain podcast. I've been photographing abandoned theaters for more than a decade, and during that time, I've met many people trying to bring these buildings back to life. Each episode dives into the history of one historic theater and tells the story of the people trying to save them from the wrecking ball. It'll be available on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your podcasts very soon.
Often, when people see an abandoned building, they ask, why doesn't someone save it? The answer is complicated and depends on a lot of factors, so each case is as individual as the place itself. As the story we're about to hear in the second part of our episode on abandoned churches shows, even when an abandoned place is bought by someone who respects it and wants to see it brought back to life, things can go terribly wrong. Today I'm joined by Matt Lambros, author and photographer behind the After the Final Curtain website and book series, and we'll be talking to Dave Golick, a member of the Chester Historical Preservation Committee. Dave and his companions had made significant strides in saving the Third Presbyterian Church in Chester, PA. But despite their best efforts, the church met a tragic end. I'm Matthew Christopher, and you're listening to Abandoned America. We are back with my friend Dave Golick now. Dave is with the Chester Historic Preservation Committee, and he's somebody that I worked with in doing photo workshops at the Third Presbyterian Church in Chester. Chester is right outside of Philadelphia to the southwest, right, Dave?
I guess, yeah, something like that. It's south of Philadelphia.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being here with us. I guess the first thing that I wanted to ask you was, when did you move to Chester and how did you become a part of the Chester Historic Preservation Committee?
Well, I bought my house in Chester. It's an old historic house, 1886. In December 79, I made settlement. And so I've been here since then. What happened was, because I'm interested in history and everything, I was interested in seeing if I could find pictures of what my house looked like, because the neighbor three doors down said, oh, you know, you live in Chester Baker's house. And I'm like, so who's Chester Baker? I didn't know anything about the history of, you know, other than William Penn came here. So that got me started. She had some kind of thing somebody typed up from the Delaware County Historical Society talking about the house and that Chester Baker was born here in 1891 and yada, yada, yada. So I thought, well, maybe there's pictures of the house. I'd like to see pictures of what it looked like, see how, you know, and then I was interested in painting it because it was painted all white. And of course, that wasn't what Victorian houses would be like. So I became friends at the Delaware County Historical Society. The lady that was the director, or whatever she was called, I can't know her title at this point, I don't remember. We became good friends and I kept looking for pictures. And there was always pictures in their photograph collection of from down the street where you could see the tip of the roof of my house or the tree in front of my house, but never my house. So I one day she called me and said, oh, Chester Baker's wife just passed away and the family gave his scrapbooks and photo albums to the Delaware County Historical Society. And she said, I think there's pictures of your house in there because he grew up in this house. So sure enough, there was. So I got copies of all those photographs and it showed it didn't show colors, of course, they're black and white, but it showed where the shading was. And then I used that to work on reproducing the colors on my house and painting it like a true Victorian house.
Well, that sounds like a really neat project, actually. So how did Third Presbyterian come into this?
Well, so the lady at the Historical Society, Judy, we talked about, this goes way back, of course, takes a long time to get to the story, but there was no historical society for Chester, PA, because Delaware County Historical had always been in Chester most of its lifetime. So we decided we were going to set up, and we set up the Chester Historical Preservation Committee, and we set that up as a nonprofit, and eventually we got the 501c3. So that was in the 80s. I think 86 was when we got the actual nonprofit status, and we'd been doing things since then. So we've had an organization going on, trying to preserve things, educate the area about Chester and its historical significance. And part of our mission was to preserve the history and historic buildings. So one of our allies in City Hall, I was in another group in the Shade Tree Commission. And anyway, she, when we had our meeting in 2014, she said, there's a demolition permit out for the Third Presbyterian Church. And she said, you've got to do something. So I had always seen that church and never been inside, but always seen it from outside. And it was just so amazing, the architecture and everything. So anyway, I went to our board on Chester Historic, and we put a resolution in that we were going to try and purchase the building or try and save it from demolition, I guess I should say. We talked to the city and they wanted to save it, but they didn't have any money. So they wanted, you know, the church to give them the money that they were going to use to demolish it. And of course, nobody's going to do that. And so I was like, well, what's going to happen if they don't give you the money? Well, there's nothing we can do. So anyway, we went to the board, pressed the resolution. I talked to the financial person at the main presbyter in Philadelphia, which, you know, owned the building at that point, owned the property. And we went back and forth, and it was negotiation back and forth. And anyway, we ended up purchasing the property for $1 from the presbytery. So we saved it from demolition.
That's pretty awesome. So I guess maybe going back a little bit here. In my notes, I have this church is designed by Isaac Purcell, who's like a notable architect. It was Gothic Revival style church. And it was started building in 1895 and opened in 1896. Am I correct in that?
Yes, that's correct. It took a year and a week about to build it.
And there were a lot of kind of cool features that this building had, right? Like the double hinged doors and the walls that could roll up and things like the way that they could extend the sanctuary and classrooms, right?
Yes, there was between the main sanctuary was in the front of the building, and that was a big domed, three-story dome, wooden dome above the sanctuary. And it was amphitheater style because at that point in time, that was the prevailing theme of a lot of the churches because it was all about the Chautauqua meetings and all that in New York. So it was built amphitheater style. So there was no center post or anything in the building. in that part of the building. And then next to the building was the rotunda. And that was really a round area around inside a square building. And between those two sections of the building were big wooden glass windows that would roll into the basement, and you could extend it into the rotunda. And the rotunda around three side had two levels of classrooms. And they had in each of those classrooms, there was a timbre that would roll up into the ceiling or come down to make the rooms larger or smaller. And it was designed that way so that this was the Sunday school part, sorry. And it was designed that way so that the person that was leading the whole Sunday school could talk to everyone in all the rooms without moving everyone around. So it was a very significant architectural thing.
I wish you could have seen this, Matt, because, yeah, those the doors that they had that rolled into the basement, I mean, they're the walls. They were wall size. I mean, they were pretty large.
They were like two stories tall, pretty much.
I've looked through your photos online, Matthew. I don't think I recall seeing any of those, unfortunately.
So the thing is that when you look at the pictures, there are two things. One is that you wouldn't necessarily identify them immediately. Okay. As something that would roll into the basement. I mean, for example, there's a picture where you can see this kind of, you know, area with the horseshoe balcony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I literally have that up on my computer right now.
Oh, okay, cool. So you see those panels in mm-hmm. the background? They were covered over with insulation.
Yeah.
That's them.
All right.
Those whole things would slide down into the basement. Wow. So, and one of the things that, you know, you mentioned, Dave, that I kind of want to go back to is the Chautauqua thing.
Yes.
So Chautauqua is kind of interesting to me because my dad lives in a Chautauqua community in Pennsylvania, and I always thought that was really fascinating. So basically, the Chautauqua thing was like kind of a rich folks summer Bible thing, but it was a little more sort of enlightened and educational, right? I mean, they would have people that were like poets and authors and, you know, et cetera, come and lecture, right?
Right. It was more an intellectual thing. And it was very progressive, I guess you would say, to their ideas and thoughts. And some of that stuff became things like a lot of the women's things like that for the women. You know, it was sort of like before the women had the right to vote, but it was something that they were working on. All those type of things were involved with that Chautauqua. And it was all based, like you said, on religious, you know, ideals also.
Which is kind of cool because it's something where they're using the ideology of religion for progressivism, which, you know, that's we could use more of that, I guess, is how we could put that. Tying in with that, right, like this Third Presbyterian was the first Bible summer school, right?
It was the first sort of curated Bible school. There were Bible schools, because we looked it up, because that's what we heard, but we looked it up, and what it was, there were Bible schools different places around the country. Like somebody would have one in their little church, but Dr. Latham quantified it and made it into a big thing. It had a syllabus, and it was very, very strict. And it was said that if you went through the whole course every summer for, I don't know how long it was like going to like a Bible college for a year because it was so intense. And the kids started out, and he did it because they wanted the people to not lose their education and their religion over the summer when there was no schooling, there was no all that type of thing. So it became world famous. I mean, people came here to see his model for the summer vacation Bible school in practice. And it was adopted basically all the churches, especially the Protestant churches all over the country and even in other parts of the world.
Yeah, that's kind of notable and interesting there. And the other thing that I had sort of wanted to go into as well was around then, I mean, Chester was a really prosperous area, right? Like you had shipyards, textile mills, and steel and iron plants. So it was really a thriving city at that point, yeah?
Yes, it was very, yeah. There were a lot of industrialists, and they became very rich. There was the Weatherall brothers. They had the Corliss steam engines that powered the boats and the shipyard, the Roach shipyards that they put the engines in. They became multimillionaires. And the people that built the Third Press, they were of that ilk, a lot of them. They were bank presidents and things like that. And because the building itself was, for its day, was expensive to build. When we look at the price now, we kind of snicker because to buy the lot and to build the building, it was $65,000, which, you know, like people's cars cost more than that today. But $65,000 back in 1895 was millions, I'm sure, that the equivalency. So, but those were all, yeah, the rich, that whole area back in the day was a very affluent area. It's down, up and down 9th Street there, there were doctors and all types of things, all types of businesses like that, that were there.
I mean, I guess what I'm understanding then is that sort of what happened in Chester was that, you know, you had a lot of people that kind of migrated to the area, a lot of different backgrounds that were working. And as they started shuttering the plants, the economy went south. This sort of, you know, like segregation was a big thing in Chester, right? Wasn't there like a big conflict over that?
There were some things in the 60s. Yeah, there were, you know, it was weird because like all the kids went to the same high school. So they all knew each other. And but there was some segregation, but in the like the schools weren't all up to the same par for the black and the white children until you got to high school. It was a kind of a weird dichotomy. It you know, there were a lot of poor people were, once the factories were working and all the industry, everybody was on kind of the same level. Once, like you said, Mike, Matthew, that when the industry started going south, the people that had good jobs that didn't have education, but they had good jobs and they were able to keep their family, buy a house, do all the things that, you know, we all want to do. Once that was gone, then there was no push to retrain people and to try and bring the people up. It was just kind of like Chester became a dumping ground almost. And it was like, oh, it's just Chester. So everything kind of went down the tubes.
By the 80s, right, most of the businesses in the area that had been supporting it were gone.
Yes, a lot. Yeah.
I mean, that really took a toll on the city as a whole. I mean, certainly like a number of places where you've seen this phenomenon where the industries all leave and kind of leave the communities holding the bag, I guess you would say, in terms right. of having this town that no longer has the jobs to support their economy. The downtown in Chester, there are a lot of closed buildings and that kind of downtown core that look like they haven't been open for probably three decades.
Right. Because Chester in its heyday, if you went downtown, like I wasn't here, I've just read and seen pictures. The downtown, like Friday and Saturday night, that was where everybody was. There was no place to park. It was so mobbed with people buying, you know, people buying and going to the stores and everything like that. So it's hard to imagine that now when you see it today.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I never saw that area. My dad grew up in Ridley Park, which is, what would that be, like 10 or 15 minutes away?
Yeah, not even, yeah.
So, I mean, when I was a kid, I went and visited his parents, but I can't say that I ever really went in Chester. But yeah, it's just interesting. It was those things.
And then there was white flight in the 60s with the race thing. There was white flight, you know, and then the malls opened up. And so a lot of the business moved to the mall and to suburbia. And it's what happened to every city for the most part. Just Chester, it happened worse to Chester than some other places because there was no leadership to kind of stem the tide and try and turn it around. It just became, like I said, and the politics were such that the politicians were using Chester for a place to dump things. Plus they were using it to say, well, we have a poor city, so we need funding. But then the funding didn't get to Chester.
That's interesting too, because I mean, the whole thing that you're talking about with white flight and malls kind of destroying the downtown core, that is something that you see happening again and again. I mean, in the periods where people who are sort of moving out of downtown cores into the suburbs, you have a lot of churches that were unable to sustain their populations because the people that were kind of keeping them going and, you know, paying all the money for their upkeep just sort of left. And then with the malls and the downtown cores, they couldn't really keep up with these suburban malls that were coming in. In fact, the malls were specifically designed to sort of thwart the idea of the downtown core. So it's like this 1-2 punch where all the people are leaving and so is all the commerce.
Right.
So is that why you would say then we have, you know, the Congregation of Third Presbyterian, I have in my notes that they folded in 1986. Would you say that was kind of a big factor in that?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, that's one of the things. Part of it is back in the day, there were no cars when it was built. The church was in 1896. Well, there might have been one or two, but nobody in Chester had one. So everything was walkability or horseability, carriageability, you know, so everything was close by. I mean, the building itself has two main entrances from the street, which tells you what was going on. So, you know, it was all that suburbia thing. A lot of it was the suburbia. People wanted to move out of the city. It's too cramped. It's too this, it's too that too. So that's what happened. Plus with the church, like so many churches, they were so, well, there were two things that happened with the congregation in, I don't know when it was, the 50s, 40s, Dr. Latham. Well, there was a split in the Presbyterian ideology. And Dr. Latham, who had built up the Third Presbyterian Church, at one point they had over 3,000 members. But when this happened, he broke with them, took the people that agreed with him out of the congregation. So the Third Presbyterian congregation was smaller. But it still buzzed along from what I can read and understand. But as people got older, nothing was done to increase the membership, as a lot of churches do. They get stuck in their ways and they don't, you know, attract younger people to take over for when they're gone. And it just got to the point that the congregation was so small that they decided to merge with the First Presbyterian Church, which was in another part of the city. So they left the building. And once the congregation leaves the building, it reverts to the property reverts to the main presbytery, which was the Philadelphia Presbytery.
Is the combined First and Third Presbyterian, are they still active?
No. They eventually disbanded to about, I don't know what it was, probably, I think it's 10. It's probably more than that because, you know, you always think it's 10 and it's 20 or something, but it's been a while. They disbanded also. So the only... Yeah, there's only one Presbyterian congregation. There's a Black Presbyterian congregation in Chester. That's the only Presbyterian congregation that's actually in the city.
So one of the things that you see a lot with, I think, many, many, many places is the death spiral sort of that you're talking about, where you have, let's say it's, I mean, you're describing a church, but let's say it's a Moose Lodge or an Odd Fellows Club. When you have members that are getting older, new people that aren't coming in, or you're talking about a mall and you have the older staple stores that are going under and you have newer stores that are coming in that aren't supporting it. You have people that aren't really patronizing it to the same level. So as it dwindles, you're facing the fact of repairs that you need for the structure, but you don't necessarily have the money or the income to do it because you're losing people. The more people you lose, the more repairs you need, the more the building sort of deteriorates, you know, the harder it is to get more people to come in. So it kind of, they feed off each other. Would you say, do you think that when, I mean, obviously this is speculation here, but do you think in 1986 the building was in need of repairs even then, or do you feel that a lot of the damage that happened to it really took place after that?
Well, I think it needed some repairs. I don't know that it was as critical as it became as time went by. Well, the presbytery didn't want to put money into it, first of all. So they didn't. And then the kids threw rocks at the stained glass windows and they finally put protection over them. But it was things like that, you know, nobody seemed to really care that much about the building. Now they did, once the congregation was gone, they did establish the East Side Ministries, which was kind of a quasi Presbyterian. The Presbytery did fund them to some degree, and they were an outreach to the community based in the church building. But they used basically the rotunda and the back addition. The sanctuary was just mothballed, and, you know, there were, over time, the roof had leaks and things like that, and those were becoming problems. That's kind of what happened. And I think the building, they got different reports. You know, they did do some work on the roof in the 80s. They got a grant through Partners for Sacred Places, I remember back then. But, you know, as time goes by, the roof is like 100 years, almost 100 years old. And so there were issues And the presbytery didn't want to spend the money to fix all those things. And when the first Eastside Ministries, Tom Tarosian, started that, he was a lot more interested in the building, and he did try to do things to preserve it more. But I think as time went by, it became overwhelming, and the next person wasn't as interested in the building per se as a historic structure. They were just in as a building to house their facilities, their outreach, and all that. So they weren't as worried, and if they could just close off the sanctuary, well, whatever, if that's rotting or leaking, well, we can't worry about that because we don't have anything, we can't do anything about that. And that's kind of, and then buildings don't like to be not used. They like to be used. So the more you don't use them, the more they deteriorate.
The sanctuary is just absolutely stunning. I mean, that was something that it really, when I first saw it, I was taken aback by how beautiful it is. But so that was pretty much left closed essentially since somewhere around 86 then. Yeah.
Yes. And they just used storage. When we got it, it was full of crap. We took out over 10 tons of stuff that was no good. The main sanctuary was just mothballed. They locked it. They didn't let anybody in there other than to throw stuff in there. People donated stuff and they just stuck it in there.
Were they maintaining the yard, the lawn and everything? I noticed
they did that. Yeah, they had a service that would mow things, but that was about it. They didn't really spend much. I think they did anything. Only maintenance they did on the building is what they had to do to keep it running, to fix the electric or have the heat on or whatever, that type of thing. But there was not any overall maintenance to preserve the structure in its historic character.
Now, when did you guys come into ownership of the building?
2015.
Okay. And were there any other buildings in the area that you guys had worked with or looked at?
Not really. We've always been interested in the 1724 courthouse that we were trying to keep that open. And that was owned by the state, but we were always trying to do things with that. But we really never had any money to speak of. And, you know, so we didn't go out like searching for buildings. But when this came up, it was something that we felt was so important, it had to be saved somehow. So
right.
it was just like a leap of faith. We have a dollar. Here's a dollar. We'll take the building, you know, to keep it from being demolished. Because every time we'd see something go wrong or something, you know, needed to be fixed, or we fixed something, we're saying, like, at least it's still here. It isn't in the dump. That was kind of a thing. And people appreciate it because it was 124 years old. So it was an iconic structure in the community, in the area.
In 2013, right, that's when Eastside Ministries sort of vanished, right? And right. At that point, I'm just sort of bridging the gap here between then and 2015. So at this point, you know, it needs repairs. Nobody knows what to do with it. They're going to demolish it. A lot of the gratings and railings and things like that were removed, right?
Yes. Well, that was what happened was they commissioned an architectural and structural person to survey the building to see what was wrong with it. The presbytery did. They paid whatever they paid to have that done. And the thing came back that there were issues. Of course, we know there were issues. Well, they used those issues to tell the Eastside Ministries, the building's going to collapse. You have to get out of there immediately. So they were forced with the thing of, what are we going to do? They had their supplies. They had big refrigerators because they had food banks. They had all kinds of stuff. So they were forced to leave and the place was shuttered. And so the presbytery kept trying to, they tried to sell it. I didn't know any of this stuff because nobody would contact us. We're just the historical society, you know. So when they knew it was going to be demolished, they started taking things out of there. And, you know, their friends needed a window. They weren't historic windows, but say they needed a window. They took the windows out and gave it to their friends, or they sold them to somebody. They took the brass railing up of the balcony there on the second floor of the rotunda. They took the chandeliers out of the main sanctuary because they were brass. All those type of things. They took the radiators out. You know, and I can't blame them per se because they thought it was going to be demolished at that point in time. So they figured, why put it in the dump when somebody can use it or we can make a couple dollars off of it? So right, not saying when they knew that the presbytery was trying to sell the building at that point in time in 13, 14. But, you know, till the demolition permit came through, we didn't know anything about all that. If we would have known earlier that it wasn't that we would stop it from demolishing, we being demolished, we probably would have been able to save you know, a lot of those things in the building, and maybe there would have been windows and all that stuff. So it's all water over the dam at this point, but that's what happened. So as you know, that survey that said, oh, or there was this and that wrong with it, and there was a leak and this beam was weakened and stuff like that, that building wasn't going to fall down. That building wasn't going to fall down unless burnt down like now, or else it got so bad that, you know, it just rotted and collapsed. But it was nowhere near the damage that they said. And I talked to the people, coincidentally, I ended up talking to the people that did that survey, and they were like, oh, well, we did the survey. And I said, yeah. And they were used that to say the building was unsafe and it should be demolished. They were like, oh my God, really? That wasn't the purpose of that survey. But people use that when they want to get rid of something. It's a liability to the presbytery, so they wanted to just get rid of it. So that's why we worked and negotiated so that we could get the building and preserve it for posterity and other things.
You've mentioned this. You've mentioned a bit about buying the building for a dollar, but I think for a lot of people, you know, just that concept is kind of crazy.
Right.
Being able to get this whole gorgeous church, like, how do you do that? I mean, how did that happen? Did somebody, you know, from the city just walk up to you and say, you know, give me a buck and the church is yours? Or, I mean,
you know, when the city said they wanted to save the building, of course, they didn't own the building. They wanted the presbytery to give the city the building and money. It was going to cost almost $300,000 to demolish the structure. As you can well know, Matthew, you've seen it. You know how sturdy and substantial it was. So that's when we went to work and, you know, I negotiated with the person at the presbytery that was the financial person. Larry Davis, that was his name. And, you know, we went back and forth and this and that, but they weren't going to give us any money. That was a given. They just wanted that off the books so that they didn't have to mow the lawn, pay insurance, worry about it falling down, whatever. It was a liability to them. So they were just glad to get rid of it, period. And it saved them almost $300,000 that it would have cost them to demolish it. So they were more than happy once we worked it all out that they would sell it to us for a dollar. And they never cashed the check. They took the check with a picture of the church and put it in a big plaque and put it in their office. So we really didn't pay anything for it.
What's funny is, so my specialty is I photograph historic theaters, you know, abandoned historic theaters. And a lot of times in the 70s and 80s, when these big single screen theaters were being sold off or closed, they were sold off to churches. And they were always sold off to churches a lot of times for like $5 or a dollar. So I find it's very funny that a church sold you a church for a dollar.
Right. And people say it was, oh, it's only a dollar, but it would have taken, as you know, Matthew, it would have been millions of dollars eventually to bring it up to where we wanted it to be for the community and everything and preserve the whole integrity of the building. None of that stuff is cheap.
You folks, when you got it, I mean, tell me a little bit about what the Chester Historic Preservation Committee is like at this point. Like, who's in it? What are what are your funds like? And what are your plans for the building?
We purchased it, and then we worked on cleaning out all the stuff that was there. There were old couches. There was just all kinds of stuff, tons and tons and tons of stuff. And like I said, it was almost 4 tons. Over the next year or so, we cleaned out of the building just so you could get in the building and be able to use it. In some, it wasn't all filled with junk. We did that initially, and then we had some of our members did some roof repairs. They were temporary for the time. They weren't what you really have to do for a permanent fix, but they kept the water out, kept things from deteriorating further. And we just worked on that. We were always fighting people trying to break in and do whatever. They were breaking the locks, cutting the screens that were where the windows were. There were real heavy screens. They would cut them and come in. It was a constant battle to keep people out of the building because I don't know what they thought was in there. But you know how that is. Abandoned buildings, Matthew. They think they're just some kind of magnetism that draws people in.
Nothing about that.
Yep. No idea. How much money do you think you spent throughout the years on keeping people outside out of the building?
Oh, thousands. I don't know exactly. I'd have to check with the treasurer, but it was thousands of dollars because we had to board up things. We had to change locks and replace locks, and they broke doors. We had to do things like that. So it was thousands of dollars, at least. I'm sure I know that. I don't know how many thousand, but it was more than a couple thousand dollars just to do those things.
Obviously, I'm on the same page with you in that I absolutely love places like these, and I think they're treasures. But let's say that you're talking to somebody who's just walking into this, and they're like, what are you even planning on doing with this church? Like, why are you even bothering keeping people out? Why are you trying to, you know, what's the end game in your mind for both this church and what's it going to do for the area around it?
Okay. So when we saw the building, once we were in there, and I'm like, Matthew, when I first came into the building and saw the sanctuary, I was just like awestruck. But what our goal was to make the sanctuary part into like a performing arts event center, because it's perfect for that. I mean, because of the way it was set up, because of the amphitheater style of the sanctuary. There were no pillars, so no seat was a bad seat. The acoustics were amazing. You could stand where the minister would stand on the podium and be in the back of the room, and it would be just like we were talking to each other. And in the auditorium, the sanctuary part seated 600 people, so it wasn't a small place. And our goal was to get that up and running along with the rotunda and all that, and make it a performing arts type thing for the city and for the greater, not just the local area and not just Chester, but the greater. I always would say it was like a mini Kimmel Center. That's what our goal was. And then all the other rooms could be used as studios, or there's a million different things we could do. So that was our goal, and to preserve it. And historic tourism is very important in an area, and people come to places because of the history. And the building had a lot of history architecturally and religiously and everything like that. So it was very important for us to preserve that and to do it for the good of the community. It wasn't for Chester Historical. The only thing we would have is we would have a museum and a little area in there just to highlight Chester history in general. But the main goal was to make it for the community. So it would be something that the community could use and would bring economic development into the area, because if you're bringing people in to go to some performance or whatever, they bring money with them.
Well, that's interesting, because, you know, that's a thing that with the Victory Theater in Holyoke, we were talking about that the other day. And there, in this case, they have a theater where they're working on turning it into a performing arts space too. And that's exactly their hope. I mean, Holyoke is a tremendously economically depressed town for a lot of the same reason. All the industries are gone. And their thought is, if they can get that going, then, you know, somebody comes in to get a sandwich before, they want to go out for a drink afterwards. I mean, you know, this is assuming we're in non-plague times, right? So basically what I'm hearing is that there's two things then that are really important about this for people to kind of understand. One is that economically, it could really be a boon for a city that needs it. And there aren't really a lot of art spaces in Chester, or even, you know, there's kind of a dearth of thriving businesses in general. And the other thing is that basically the city's already lost a lot of its architectural heritage. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Yep.
What would you say really are the major things that are kind of left over from the days of its prosperity, or I guess maybe more to the point, what are some of the things that it's lost that are gone now?
Well, there's a lot of buildings, a lot of historic housing, things like the shipyard and the Ford Motor Plant, all those things are gone. There's so much that's gone just everywhere. The neighborhoods are torn down. There's big empty spaces. There's only about six or seven things on the National Register in Chester. And of course, Chester goes back to before 1682 when William Penn came. So there's a lot of missing history. A lot of buildings that, you know, were torn down, burnt down, I don't know, I could go on and on. I can't offhand just say name one by one.
Oh, yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, I don't think people would necessarily want an exhaustive list. I'm just looking for exactly what you gave, which is more of a sort of general overview. So you're looking at turning this into a performing arts space. You're hoping that it's going to bring some things back in terms of businesses. I'm sure you're familiar with the halo effect, which is churches supposedly have this, they lower crime around them, which I think is weird. And what were you folks doing? One of the things too, I mentioned this earlier, I mean, how big is CHPC?
Not very big. We have about 10 members and we have some allies, and that's pretty much it. And that's always been the problem. Just like every organization, like what you're talking about earlier, how do you get people involved? How do you keep people to stay? And we don't have many young people in our organization, even at the 10 people or so that we have. So it's not a big group. Everybody's very dedicated and hardworking, but there's only so much you can do with a small group. And that's been a drawback.
How many of those members are millionaires?
Zero. Everybody's a working class or retired person, yes.
This is something that you're doing because you love your community, because you care about the building, and it's really a pretty enormous uphill struggle, I think, when you see people that are doing this. I mean, there's a lot of things. Time is working against you. Decay is working against you. Finances are working against you. But you had made a number of pretty significant, I would say, achievements, right? Like last year.
Right.
Like right. The being listed. Would you, you know, could you tell me a little more about that?
Right. We were through Partners for Sacred Places, a benefactor gave them the money to hire a person that could write the National Register of Historic Places nomination for the church. So she did that. She's a skilled person at doing this thing. She's done these things before. So she wrote a very good nomination. And last June, we went to Chambersburg, where the meeting was of the review board for the, you have to be approved by the state that you're in. And that once the state approves you, it's a shoo-in to be on the National Register. Then it goes to the Park Service and the federal government, and they list you as a site on the National Register of Historic Places. So we did that. We were approved. The nomination was perfect. We didn't have to do anything. Some of them, you know, they have to tweak them certain ways. She did a great job. The committee was fab. You know, the review committee from the state was, they just thought it was great. And they were so thrilled that we had the church up for, you know, nomination, and it was totally approved. So we were on the National Register as well. We were on the state register as of June, and then until it goes through the process, all the paperwork, we were on the National Register before the end of last year.
So what does that mean when you're on the National Register? I mean, people, I think one of the things that I notice when I talk to people is people say, oh, well, you know, that place is on the register, they can't demolish it now, or why are people not, like, I think there are a lot of misconceptions about what that status really confers. So what did that mean in practical terms for you?
Well, in for us, in practical terms, it made us credible. We weren't just a bunch of silly old people from Chester trying to save some moldering church building. We were trying to save something that was important to the nation. I mean, it was a historic site that was important to the country. And you know, it doesn't keep it from being demolished. I mean, we own it, so we're the ones that can demolish it or not. But a lot of buildings are owned by the group, so they can be demolished. It provides substantiation. And hopefully, you know, that's what we were working toward, to help us make us more likely to get some funding and things to help do repairs and restoration of the building. We hadn't quite got to that point when, you know, things happened. But it's not like putting a whole envelope around the building and say it's protected. Nobody can do anything to it. That's a misnomer. Unfortunately, I wish it was that way, because that would be much better for a lot of historic buildings.
So it's a symbolic thing, but it's an important symbolic thing if you're a group, because it's showing that, you know, this is something that's worth investing in. And as far as the the paperwork that goes, I mean, it's not like you could just get an intern to do that. That's a fairly complicated process, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. She worked on it for a long time. And that hers was so good. Her nomination was so good because she did all the research. She had all the sources that she used to document what she wrote. It was all part of it. So it was a complete nomination. It had from A to Z that was needed to present it, to make it a viable thing to put on the National Register. And it cost thousands and thousands of dollars that thankfully we had a grantee that paid for it, because it's a good chunk of change.
And that's what Partners for Sacred Places helped you with?
Yes. Yes. They got the grant so then they hired the person. And then, you know, I took her through the building and she did research. And yeah, that was how we were able to do it. That's how we were able to do it really seamlessly. It was put in and it was approved and that was it. I've worked on other National Register nominations for other things. And usually they come back because you haven't provided all the information they need because you're not familiar with the whole process. She was familiar with the whole process. She'd done all the research. She had done many of these before, and she was a known quantity that they knew she did good work. And so when they read her thing, they were all on board.
So is this Rachel Hildebrandt that you were working with?
Rachel, yeah. Rachel.
She's awesome. At this point, right, like sort of bringing myself into the story here, I met you 2 or 3 years ago, yeah? At that point, I was really, really impressed with when I met you and the other people in CHPC. I mean, just with how passionate you were about the building, but also just a really kind and friendly. And, you know, when I started doing the workshops and people were coming in to see this place, first of all, I think everybody was really blown away by just how gorgeous the building was and how many nice features there were to it that were sort of unexpected, like the light in the stairway, how pretty that was. But also, I think they really enjoyed just how you made them feel at home and welcome in it. And that was sort of a really cool thing that just seeing that, I mean, you know, you didn't have this building to sort of hoard it and keep it to yourself. You wanted to share it with other people.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were very, very proud of the building. We still are, and just in a different way, but we wanted everybody to see it. We were just so proud of it. And just, it was so wonderful. Nobody should miss out on the experience of seeing the building. You know, that's where we were at. We were all that way. Everybody in their own way was that way. And you met some of the members. So, you know, everybody was like that. We were just, you know, we're just a nice group. I mean, you know, everybody has their things and this and that, but we're a nice group. We want to share everything. We're doing it for the good of the whole, not for ourselves.
Yeah, I think that really came across and was something that was really neat about it was, for example, another group that I've worked with and doing photo workshops and things like that is the Friends of Mount Moriah Cemetery. You know, basically what you have there is this beautiful cemetery that was neglected for years, and they've sort of come together and work to clean it out and to recover the graves and recover the records. And the greater point here is that there's this really cool community that's built around it. And you have this kind of fellowship among the people that are working on it. And it's very welcoming. I mean, you know, it's very nice to deal with a group of people that are excited and enthusiastic about what they're doing and just happy to show it to other people and have them see what it is that makes it special and important too.
Definitely.
I hate to do it because, you know, it's like the part here that, you know, none of us are really a big fan of, but I mean, let's talk then a little bit about the actual, you know, what happened to the building this year, I guess.
Okay.
What was your experience with that?
Well, May 28th, my neighbor, my board member, Helen, down the street called me. It started out, somebody texted me on my phone at like 6 a.m. and I saw who it was. And it was like, it's a friend of mine and he's a historian, but I'm like, oh, he's just probably being annoying. So I'm going to ignore it. But he was texting me to tell me that the church was on fire. But then Helen called a little while after that, and I would listen to her because she's my neighbor and just down the street, and she's older. So her daughter had seen it on the news that the church was on fire.
What did you do then? I mean,
we got in our cars. I threw on some clothes. We got in our cars. By then, it was already way past. But we got in our cars and drove down there and got as close as they would allow us. And we just watched them put out the fire. By then, the whole building was basically burnt down by that point. I mean, they had the water cannons and, you know, we're just dousing everything with water. There was a little bit of flames in the portico share and everything else was just collapsed. The whole roof had collapsed in. The stained glass was gone. Everything was gone. And we were just like in shock, I think, you know. And of course, I mean, with all that and if people are standing around in the pandemic and, you know, people aren't wearing masks. So it was just all like hyper horrible. That's all I can say. So we watched that for a while. I stayed. The ATF, they came and talked to me about the situation. And they felt like it was arson. Because at that point, when the building was going to be demolished before we took it over, they had cut off all the services. So there was no electric, there was no gas. So there was nothing to start that building on fire just spontaneously. Somebody had to set it. Somebody had to get in there and set the building, you know, get it started, some kind of incendiary device so that it would go. I mean, because Matthew, as you know, you've been in there, that building, there wasn't stuff that would burn easily. I mean, right. Wood will burn, but you can't just hold a match to it and it catch it on fire. There was nothing like that. There were no papers and things like that. So it had to be. So they talked to me, the special investigation unit from the state police were there. They talked to me. They questioned me about, you know, do we have any enemies? Do we this? Do we that? And like, not that I know of. And firemen, I talked to everyone, but the consensus was that, you know, it was arson.
This is one of the very things that you have, why you're fighting to keep the doors locked and the grates cut. And when you have people that are continuously breaking into the building to take pictures, they're also leaving it open for somebody to come in and burn it.
Right, right.
Or otherwise damage it. So, I mean, I think sometimes there's this sense that when you have an abandoned building, that you know, it's no big deal if the doors are on or off, because who cares? You know, who cares if people go in? But you basically are trying to keep the building secure so that you can save it. I mean, that's the end goal. And this is what happens right when you know, when people are sneaking into it. Yeah, just that's it's really heartbreaking. I remember for me, you know, a lot of the people that were in the group were texting me about it. And I was like, oh, my God, is this, you're not already horrible? Like, why do we need more horrible this year?
Right, and right.
I knew that when I contacted you, I mean, I just knew that this was going to be something really devastating, because it's not like you folks have 10 churches that you're working with that, you know, you can move on to one of the other ones. I mean, this was what you had put a lot of your time and effort into.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Become just a really nightmare scenario, basically.
I went there a day or two afterwards. And I mean, it's pretty much the shell at this point, right? The windows are all gone. It's just the stone part of the building.
Right. Right. The historic part is just walls. Some flooring's left, most of it's gone. Like all our concern is now that the walls, we can stabilize the walls and make sure they don't fall down. The back section, the educational section or whatever you want to call it, that was added in 1922, that's the most intact. The roof burned off and a little bit of the walls, but basically it's intact. And, you know, we're hoping that we can kind of rehabilitate that to the point where at least we can start doing something to bring in income or help the community in some way. The library is interested in putting a branch there, different things like that. So we're hoping, but we've got to get to the point where we preserve what's left of that back part too. So it's been a monumental task, to say the least, and cost money. And that's always the rub on everything, the money part.
The fire started in the room that I had the groups meet in. When that was what you had said, right?
There was right. We called it our boardroom, but it was the one with the fireplace in it there with the big table. And that's what they think, that's where it started.
And there wasn't really anything that was particularly, it's not like that was where you kept your big pile of gas-soaked rags or whatever.
Right. No, that's what I mean. There was hardly anything. There was a little bit of stuff we kept in the closet, stuff we saved in the closet, in the one closet. That was it. It wasn't like it would just, you know, you just throw a match in there, it would go poof and everything would start burning. And apparently, from what we understand, the one lady lives, she's kind of our guardian now, watches over there. She lives on Upland Street, which is her backyard, faces the side of the parking lot. But she went out at 1:30 in the morning that day to take her dogs out because she has a puppy, and there was nothing. By 2:30, when the fire trucks came, it was already fully engulfed, and the chief said it was ahead of them. It was already ahead of them by then. So, you know, it happened really pretty quickly, whatever it was. She didn't see anything. You would have seen smoke or something at 1:30 if it was just slowly burning. So somebody had to really...
Was there an arson investigation? Did they find like accelerant or anything?
Well, I don't know. They've never gotten back to us, and I need to try and see if I can get a hold of them. Nobody's gotten back to us. That's what they initially thought. That it was, you know, ATF came and the special unit of the state police came, but they've never gotten back to us about the real, you know, that was just what they said that day. That's what we've been going with because we didn't have any other information.
You know, the building didn't have power, right?
Right. There was no power, no gas, nothing.
No lightning storms in the area?
No, nothing. No.
I would say pretty likely then that, yeah, arson.
Right, right.
I mean, have there been other buildings in the area that have been burned down?
Not that I know of. No. I think, my theory is that somebody that's an arsonist and they like to see things burn. And like somebody said, they were probably standing in the people around there watching it burn while it was burning down. I don't know. I mean, that's just a theory, but that's what happens a lot of times. People like to watch things. They're arsonists. They like to watch it burn. But I just can't imagine how somebody could do that to destroy such a beautiful thing. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, that is a damn shame. Sometimes though, there's a theater in Connecticut that was burned by three high school students that just were going around old buildings and setting fires just because they could, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. They asked us if we had any enemies or anything like that. And I don't know that we did. We didn't know. If we did, we didn't know we had them. And we had the blink cameras up, but, you know, we didn't have I was working on that too, Matthew and Matt. I was working on that getting, because you have to have some kind of internet capacity for them to transmit things to you. And there's no internet thing because there's no electric in the building. So I was working to see if I could get some kind of solar powered thing like that. But of course, it was too late by the time. So I don't know if they took the blink cameras that we had installed, but I don't know. We haven't heard. See, nobody gets back to you. And if you don't track everybody down, so I'm going to have to track everybody down. I don't know if they record, if there's anything recorded somehow from that or not.
I remember the first thing that, you know, I saw when I came up to it, aside from, oh my God, like, you know, the whole roof is gone. All the windows are gone. But really struck me that there were flowers that were set on the step next to the cornerstone. At this point, I mean, where do you go from there? Like, are you planning on trying to keep the remaining walls in any sense? Is that a thing? Or do you, you know, where do you foresee this going at this point?
Well, what optimally we'd like to do, and I've had people come out to give us estimates, which are just estimates to verify what's going on, but we'd love to rebuild to some capacity, save the walls that we can. And of course, we're not going to be able to build like it was because, you know, that would take like $500 million or something. Who knows? But we'd like to stabilize the walls and be able to rebuild something in, you know, with those walls on the outside to preserve the historic part as much as we could. And do the same thing that we were planning to do, but of course it's going to be different now as far as what it's going to look like. That's our ultimate goal. At this point, we want to try and keep the back part so that we can get that, do something with that initially to help the community, whatever.
I think we're running out of time here, but one of the things that I really wanted to kind of ask, there are sort of, I'd say, two big questions. I mean, is there anything that you've learned from this or hope that others would learn from it? I know that's kind of an odd question because, you know, what is your takeaway from that? But, I mean, what is your takeaway from it?
Well, I think the whole thing would be different, I think, if we would have started out differently as far as communication, if there would have been more communication among, like I talked before about the city and the presbytery and all that. Maybe we would have not had the problems we started out with. We got the building with problems because we didn't have electric. We didn't have windows. We didn't have gas. You know, they took the plumbing and messed up the pipes and things like that, the heating systems, all that. If those things would have been intact, maybe this would have never happened. I know that's, you know, going back. You can't look back. But I think... The build, if somebody that gets a building, if it, the more intact it is, the better off you're in starting out. Because the building had a security system, they had a fire system and all that, but there was no power. And why are you going to turn the power on if we don't even know what's going on? Because they took things and, you know, ripped things out and pulled out windows and stuff like that. So, I mean, that would have been one thing to stop the intrusion as much as there was. And it would have started, we have started out at a higher level in rehabbing and restoring the building. It's a tough thing to keep people out, as you know, out of abandoned buildings. And it wasn't abandoned, but they people perceived it that way because somebody wasn't there 24/7. And I don't know what else to learn. I don't know, Matthew.
No, that's okay. I mean, I'm not expecting some grand life lesson. I just sort of, I think what you said is exactly what I was looking for. I mean, what are the things that you think about when you look back at it? And so the other question that I have to kind of leave it on is, do you have any, for people that are listening to this, do you have a call for action to people who've heard the story? Like, what could they do to help your organization or other people like you that is going to, you know, somebody says, oh my God, this is awful. Like, what can I do to keep this thing from happening again down the road?
Well, keep it from happening. Like I said, I think there has to be communication. There has to be, you know, some whoever has the building, whoever wants the building, whoever wants to preserve the building, there has to be a dialogue there to keep something like from this happening as likely as it did. And it always boils down to, in the end, it boils down to money. The money is what makes or breaks anything, unfortunately. I mean, as far as the physical structure, didn't make or break us as a group, but it broke the structure for a lot and now it's like the money to, and anybody that's doing that with any of these buildings, that's always the problem. It's hard to get people involved and appreciate historic things like this because we're not, a lot of people aren't programmed that way. The country isn't really programmed that way. It's always, oh, this is new. This is, let's rip out our old kitchen because it's 10 years old and put a new kitchen in. So the mentality isn't so much, it's a small group of people like us that like historic things and want to preserve that. And the people that appreciate it in the end, when it's done, they appreciate that it's done and it's really cool, but it's the in between part. They don't understand that you need to save it to preserve it so that they can enjoy it later. They don't get that connection. And I think that's what we've always tried to do is educate people about the history of Chester and do things like that to hopefully, you know, educate people so they'll appreciate it. And they may try to help more and may want to save it and understand how it's beneficial to the community and to the greater good.
It sounds like then that finding groups that are like you and kind of supporting and also participating and joining them would be helpful. Yeah.
Yes. Cause even if they don't have, even if people don't have money, if they have time, there's lots of things that they could help to save a building time-wise. You know, they could campaign to save it. They could talk to people to save it. They could do all those things that don't cost any money. And that's a beginning. That's the beginning step. Like initially, you know, we didn't pay any money to get the building because we worked on it and negotiated and talked to people and tried to get everything, our ducks lined up. But then after that, then you have to reach out further to get, you know, and we just are working on that. We never had to do that before we got this building. So we weren't really savvy, and we didn't really have people that were savvy in trying to get grants and things like that. And fundraising, we're working on that. And that's been a struggle, because fundraising is hard to start with. And if you don't know what you're doing, it's even harder.
Matt, do you have anything you'd like to throw in there before we wrap up?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I totally understand that. As someone who is on the board of a historical preservation, I'm on the board of the Theater Historical Society of America. And I know just from that how hard fundraising and grant writing is, and finding the grants and that are your organization is eligible for is also kind of a pain. But what I was going to say is, so to kind of jump on Matthew's question, how can people get involved with your organization if they want to?
Well, we do have a website. We do have a Facebook page, so they could, you know, they could contact us through that. We do like Facebook. Helen usually answers anybody that contacts, puts anything on Facebook, or if it's email, Helen or I answer the person and I'll call them or talk to them or, you know, try and get them involved. So that's the basic way they can help us. We're working on things like doing a GoFundMe page and things like that, but we haven't gotten to that point yet. And it's, you know, it's tough because people have good intentions and they want to help, but sometimes it's hard for them to follow through for whatever reason through their circumstances. So we deal with that a lot, where people are really gung-ho and want to help, but they don't, even if you give them some way to help, they don't always follow through. Now, I'm not blaming or criticizing anybody saying that. I'm just saying that's the reality of the situation. So, you know, so anytime we can hook somebody and reel them in, man, we do, you know. So we appreciate any help, volunteers, lobbyists that will lobby for us, you know, find those $1 million checks on the sidewalk. Anything like that is great.
Well, we'll put the information to all of, you know, your Facebook and links and everything in the show notes.
Great.
Yeah. So basically, if people look up Chester Historic Preservation Committee on Facebook, and your website is chesterpreservation.org. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Dave Golick, thank you so much for being here with us today and for, you know, telling us the story. I really appreciate it. And I hope you have a great rest of your morning.
Well, thanks, Matt and Matthew. I really appreciate you giving me the time to talk about our gem that we're trying to preserve and save or rehab and everything. I really appreciate it.
Well, that does it for our two-part series on churches. I'd like to thank Dave Golick and Matt Lambrose for joining me here today, and I'd also like to thank you for listening. In our next episode, we'll be talking about the wild history of resorts in the Catskills, why so many of them closed, and we'll share what is perhaps the most epic lifelong rivalry started over fried chicken in the history of mankind. See you there.